This is Tim.
And Brandon.
And this is Deconstructing Comics. Welcome to Deconstructing Comics, sponsored by ComicsNow.com. Today, Brandon and I are going to talk about Super Spy by Matt Kint. This was provided to us by our sponsor, ComicsNow.com. And I chose it out of previews based mostly on the fact that it was published by Top Shelf, which is Alex Robinson's publisher. We've talked about Tricked and Box Office Poison on past podcasts, and I just kind of had the impression that Top Shelf stuff must be pretty good, so I thought we'd give this a chance.
Good choice.
Yeah, I was pretty pleased with it.
Me too.
First of all, it smells really interesting.
I didn't even try to smell it.
That was the first thing I noticed about the book. Like, this is a interesting book smell.
A little like turpentine.
But, yeah, so this is a story about spies during World War II. And at first, it felt like it was just going to be kind of episodic and... just like a bunch of self-contained stories. But then after a while, I started to see where they connected with each other. Now, this book is put together like out of chronology. And I read it through once front to back, and then I read it through again in chronological
order.
Yeah.
Following the dossier numbers?
Right. Each chapter has a case number, a dossier number, and those numbers are in the table of contents also, so you can track down the next chapter in sequence.
I haven't tried that. How much of it is out of order?
It's pretty far out of order.
Wow. Yeah.
Although it sort of goes from front to back, except number 23 is placed fourth in the book. So you're turning way back to that. But reading it through in chronology, I picked up a few things that I didn't pick up the first time.
Oh, really?
Yeah, well, like in the fourth chapter, which is dossier 23, that French guy shows up, who we see more of later, but I wasn't looking for him yet. In the fourth chapter, because that's his first appearance in the book. If you're reading front to back,
what page is that on?
Some of the pages are numbered. Page 41. Yeah, most of the pages do have page numbers. So that's nice. Yeah, the guy who's dressed in typical French clothes. With a mustache and everything.
Could have been out of his girlfriend.
Later we see him with his girlfriend or wife or whatever. Part of what's interesting about this book is how color is used. Many of the pages are just black and one other color, but then other pages are more or less completely colored, and he uses it in very strategic ways. Like the scene where they're that female assassin and the other guy, Alan, end up in that sewer, and what's actually happening is in black and white, and the things that they're thinking about doing to each other are in color.
Yeah, I thought color was supposed to be my thing, right?
Okay, sorry.
No, it's not bad. Yeah, it was one of the things that I wanted to bring up because I really like the way they use color because it's not only is it just strategically used, it really emphasizes or what's another term I could use? It really creates a certain feeling or mood about the story that it is reminiscent of like an old black and white spy movie. It's really cool.
Yeah. Now, and there are things that kind of, that follow through from one story to another, but it's very subtle. There were, some details that I completely missed the first time through.
Are we moving on from color?
Okay, did you want to say something more about color? I'm sorry. It's just
Well, I just
there's so
wanted
much to say about this book, but
to kind of put the, yeah, I know, to kind of put the technical terms that you're put a name technically to the things that you're mentioning.
okay.
The color combination or the color harmony that was primarily being used that you mentioned was what they call duotone, which is two colors primarily that you're going to use. One of them here, of course, is black, and then the other would be whatever color he chooses for that page. We see brown every once in a while, green maybe a little bit,
Some
blue, those
blue.
kind of things. Yeah. And then, of course, the whole full color thing is a four color process. I think it's kind of interesting because even like the texture on the pages is printed on the pages, of course. So it's not the paper itself, although I guess they could have chosen to do that. It looks like they probably went through and even on the pages that only appear to be two colors, they still have that background texture of what you would think is the paper with like coffee stains on it and stuff. So that's got another color added to it anyway. Okay, so that's all I wanted to say about the color. It is done in a way more consistent with the DC coloring method than with Marvel's coloring method. I think we mentioned before that DC, they seem to be more skillful with their use of color. There's more purpose to it, where Marvel comics tend to be just like, let's see how many Photoshop filters we can add to the page. I really like how simple and flat it seems, but it really does a very good job of affecting the reader emotionally. Okay, so that's it.
Okay. One place where I had to, on the second time through, I was sort of looking through those sections over and over again to figure out what exactly had happened. Between pages 149 and 160, these are dossier numbers 15 and 13. And there's some overlap between the two chapters. Some of the same panels appear in both of them. They're just from different points of view. And it took me a little while to fit it all together that this woman who is a spy and she has a baby or small boy. Apparently, she misidentifies the room that the spy is in. Did you catch that?
I'm trying to follow on. You said it starts on page 164.
Yeah, well, look especially at 155, 156. On the second floor of this building, there's a room 2 and there's a room 2A. And she traces the German spy. I think that they're in France. In many of these chapters take place in France. She traces him to or follows him to room 2A, but then for some reason the message that she sends says that he's in room 2. And as a result, the little old lady in room 2 gets knocked off.
One person gets killed.
Yeah. But it was really subtle because, well, and part of what threw me was that I couldn't figure out who they were talking about. The old lady, the only time you ever see her is on page 150. When you see the German spy with his headphones on, because he's listening to the people downstairs. And you just happen to see a glimpse of the woman next door in room two. Now, I don't know why a house would have a room two and a room 2A. That doesn't quite make sense to me. But anyway, minor point.
So that there could be a mistake.
Yeah, exactly. Facilitates the mistake that is the story. But besides the colors, he uses some different methods of telling the story, where sometimes it's more just prose and illustration.
Or it's word specific.
Right. Or there are a few pages, there's one chapter that's done sideways. You have to turn the book sideways to read it.
Yeah.
And that one also happens to be in full color, pretty much. Although I wonder why that one's in color. Did you have any thoughts on that? The story with the car crash.
What page is that on?
Starts on 66.
The guy with the patch.
Right.
You know, I'm pretty impressed with the book overall because while you're reading through it, well, at least while I was reading through it, I wasn't thinking to myself, well, this is really weird. I was just kind of going along with it.
Yeah, oh, okay, you have to turn the book sideways, all right, sure, that's fine.
Because, I mean, he varies each story to kind of give each dossier, each case, its own voice or its own personality.
Yeah.
So each little story that you read, not only are you getting introduced to new characters and the story seems a little bit different than the last one, the colors are different, and the way, even the illustration technique seems to be a little bit different. So I guess it, within the first couple chapters, it had me guessing so much that I just kind of went along with, I was intrigued by it anyway. I mean, even when you very first start out, you look at the front cover, and did you even attempt to decode the front cover?
Decode the front cover.
Yeah.
No, I guess it didn't occur to me that there might be something encoded here.
Under a super spy, they give you the key on, I guess it would be page 5 or something.
Oh, I see. Yeah, there's some shorts and longs.
Yeah.
Kind of Morse code.
I don't know that it's truly Morse code. It looks like it is, yeah.
But yeah, because S is 3 shorts and O is 3 longs. It's like, yeah. You know, SOS.
Right.
Yeah, so it's Morse code. Yeah, it's written in there in the title on the cover. Yeah, didn't catch that.
And as soon as I opened it up and I saw that page, I did that. But all these little, it's not really even gimmicky, but all these little tricks and clues that are throughout the book put me as a reader in a place where I wasn't going to question what he was going to do next. I was just kind of along for the ride. So if we're analyzing why he turned things sideways, I think maybe that's why. It's just so that he can give a different voice to each story, even though they're all within the same continuum.
Yeah, that could be.
I like how they were all linked.
Yeah.
It's really, to me, another masterpiece. It's very similar to how I felt about Tricked.
Yeah, it's similar. Yeah, go ahead. I know what you're gonna say, but
because the artwork is very it's fairly simple, but once again, just like Alex Robinson, he's able to display a great deal of emotion and character through each illustration, and then as you go through the story, you see how it seems like a random series of people that aren't connected, but as you go through, you start to see that they are actually connected.
Yeah, which is what makes it similar to Tricked.
Right. And there's a bigger story going on rather than if you were to go through like a typical comic book, maybe you would choose just one character to follow all the way through. But the whole dynamic of having six different characters.
At least. It might have been more than that.
Okay, several different characters all telling different parts of the same story. To me, that's like, it's beyond what a typical writer would be able to do. It's one that next step where you're saying, well, this guy is like an awesome writer. Even with just regular prose books, when you have somebody that takes the plot to that level, to where you're actually guessing and guessing wrong, or you can't guess at all what's going to happen next. Those are the kind of books and stories that I like.
Yeah, it's intricate and complex, and also makes some interesting points and has some interesting symbolism in it. Like the bit with the snowflake, in the chapter called Spite.
Just a force of nature, is that the one?
Right. And the scene from the air, of the what's left over after that assassin leaves, resembles the shape of the snowflake.
Yeah, it's an interesting transition.
Oh,
Then
and
the chapter begins out that way, right?
right, snowflake at the beginning and at the end of that chapter.
So you have a loop.
And that's also the chapter where that lamp appears, and then that it appears again at the end, and the guy with a different in a different setting, and the guy says he picked it up at a Russian secondhand shop or something.
I like how he does that. He picks little pieces and brings them back in later.
Yeah, and the Arabian Nights book shows up later too.
It's kind of similar to old James Bond movies. You get something in the beginning where you think it's relatively unimportant, and then you see, well, oh, it came back. There was something to that. But nowadays, you just kind of expect that. Not in the way that Super Spy was written, but like somebody will make a comment, and then at some point, if it's a bad guy saying something, and it's initially insulting, later the hero's going to come back and say it right back to the bad guy. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like there will be some rude comment or something, and then the writer will think it's clever to bring it right back and throw it in that person's face. It seems like there are a lot of films and maybe even books that are built around that entire concept. It's like revenge in some sense. It's supposed to be ironic, I think. But I like the way that he does it. It's not overplayed like how we see it in Hollywood movies.
Yeah. And one technique of his that I liked is how often through the book, when he's showing that something is inside something else, he'll put that thing in there in sort of a what's it, what is it exactly? It's like a lightened version. I can't find the words I want to describe it, but
Can you tell me a page? Can
well,
you have
for
a little
example,
example?
page 186, where the guy is hiding in the trash can, and you see the trash can in a darker line, and then you see
A
him,
silhouette.
hiding inside it in a kind of a
Like
lighter
an
line.
X-ray thing, right?
Yeah. And he uses that in a number of different places.
He does a cross section of the floor where what is it being hidden there?
Oh,
It's a code book?
the Arabian Nights book, yeah, that they're
Yeah.
using as a code book. Yeah, that's more of a cross section thing, but this sort of
This is
lighter
like an
line,
X-ray.
like when the knife is in the file cabinet, remember, and the assassin with the scar on her face refers to, you know, she already knows that it's there.
Yeah.
And you can see that knife kind of, it's like you have x-ray vision.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
One last thing I wanted to say about the book is that, what was I going to say? I completely lost it. When you said the knife thing, I forgot. Is there anything else you wanted to say about it? Oh, it was about the writing.
Okay.
And I don't remember what it was about the writing.
Okay.
Yeah, you're going to have to cut most of this out. I don't know if this is it or not, but I'll just say it. I was really intrigued by how, you know, the, once again, you know, how we talked about the contrast between, like, Art Spiegelman's style when he's telling the mouse story.
Mm-hmm.
It's very cartoony, but it's a really serious subject matter.
Mm-hmm.
I like how this book is similar in that sense, but you don't get the, it's not a playful kind of feeling that you get from the illustrations. The illustrations are themselves kind of, you know, kind of innocent folk art kind of looking.
Mm-hmm.
They're kind of flat, but you really get a sense of tension and
yeah, it's simple art, but it's not whimsical.
No, but it is cartoony. I mean, it's just
uh-huh.
It still gives a very adult feeling to the book. I wanted to bring back into I wanted to mention, I don't know if you want to talk about it, but Black Diamond. One of the things I was emphasizing last time that we talked,
mm-hmm.
May have seemed silly to maybe a listener or to you. I was talking about the car and how I would have chosen a different muscle car.
Uh-huh.
I think one of the essential skills that a writer needs to embrace is like the research for the story. They have to give like plausibility to their story, to where somebody who knows at least a little bit about the subject will be able to go, oh yeah, that's true. Or I can believe that, you know. Kind of put them, I think I've talked about it before, and Scott McCloud talks about the suspension of disbelief.
Mm-hmm.
So when you start reading a story, initially a reader is going to be like, oh, this is just another fiction story, it's fake, or whatever. Mm-hmm. But you want to get them involved, you want them to believe that this could really happen. And with Super Spy, we've all seen spy movies, we've probably read some stories that are like, you know, qualify as spy stories. I can think of Queen and Country,
mm-hmm.
as one of those stories.
Uh-huh.
So the person who's going to read this book, because of the title alone, you know, they're going to have some experience that they're going to bring to the table that the writer has to be able to accommodate and improve upon throughout the story, so that that reader is really involved in it. In Black Diamond, the guy really didn't do that, because, you know, he chooses a muscle car that really isn't a muscle car.
Mm-hmm.
And anyone who kind of likes muscle cars or that genre of film, comic books, whatever, just would be going, what is he doing? You know, I can't believe this. It's wrong. It's just wrong. I did a little more research on the Mercury Cougar from 1973,
uh-huh.
And it's not even considered a true muscle car at that point. I mean, it had the tag. It's built on the Ford Mustang frame, but they had the Eliminator, which is actually the picture of the car in the book, was not a 1973 model. It had been stopped. It had been eliminated by, like, 1971. And the Eliminator was a big engine in the car. By the time it got to 1973, if you look in the internet, the car isn't even spec for horsepower anymore, because they had put such a weak little engine in it that it really doesn't, there's no muscle there, you know? But with Super Spy, I don't think there was a single time that I was going, well, that's phony. I was in these people's lives in Germany or wherever they were during World War II going, I was just, I was 100% with the story. Where with Black Diamond, you had brought up, the fact that you didn't understand why they would build a super highway for the ghetto.
Yes.
This doesn't make sense. Super Spy is the exact opposite. It's a book where all along you're seeing one, either a confirmation of things that you know from that specific genre in the past, or if it's a departure from that, it's a believable departure.
Yeah.
Like, even something as simple as a weapon. You're not going to see them come out with a thermonuclear handheld device from like Star Wars. But
No,
Star
no,
Wars, we can believe it. Star Wars is a completely in-world alien
no.
situation. But in Super Spy, we see like switchblades and handguns that are to that period. Matt Kent, I would put him in that same class as Alex Robinson.
Yeah, me too.
This book, to me, is a masterpiece. I'm so glad that you purchased it.
Well, I'm starting to think that maybe all books published by Top Shelf are this good.
Well, I'd hope so. I don't know if we can say that yet. We got to get a couple more, huh?
Yeah, I'll have to see if that theory holds out through the rest of what they publish.
I want to bring up a different subject. Is it okay
Sure.
to move on? I picked up a book at the local Barnes and Noble. It's a English magazine. It's called Tripwire, and
Tripwire.
it's a 132-page annual. It's got a picture of Hellboy on the cover, so I mean, it caught my attention right off the bat. It's a general magazine that covers comics, film, TV, and more, it says. And initially, the thing that had me look into the cover was, yeah, it's got a picture of Hellboy, but it says it's got news on what is to come as far as the film franchise and the comic book franchise. So I open it up, and it's got really good articles. I really like the magazine, so in the future, I'll probably either purchase more or get a subscription to it. But the thing that I thought we might find interesting was, one, that they do a lot of articles on books that we have read that we said were good. So
Okay.
that's a
So
plus.
they have good taste.
Yeah. But they also have a couple of different lists. They have this power list that talks about the most powerful people in those industries, and they have this list of books, 12 graphic novels that you probably haven't read but should, I think it's called. I'm looking for
Yeah, maybe we can get a few good recommendations from there.
it. Well, and that's what I was thinking. A couple of the books we have read, and they were books that we both liked, so I figured,
Which
if
ones were
that.
those?
Alex Robinson's Trick was one of them.
Okay. And Batgirl Ghost? No,
No, it was Batman and Tarzan.
That masterpiece.
Right. Okay, it's called 14. It's on page 115. 14 graphic novels you probably haven't read, but should have. They have one by David Hein called Strange Embrace. That was number one. Number two is The Adventures of Luther Arkwright by Brian Talbot. Brian Talbot is always a name that continues to come up in comics. A lot of people respect him. Number three, Hooligan's Haircut by Peter Milligan and Jamie Hewlett by Rebellion Books. Box Office Poison by Alex Robinson, Top
Okay.
Shelf Productions. Two-Fisted Tales by Harvey Kurtzman, EC Archives. Locus A Love and Rockets book by Jamie Hernandez.
Okay.
Xenozoic Tales, books 1 and 2 by Mark Schultz. King David by Kyle Baker. That one was kind of a surprise. Constantine Hellblazer, All His Engines by Mike Carey and Leonardo Monco.
Okay.
David Boring by David Close, by Daniel Close. That's one of the books that I had read. I don't know that you picked that one up, though.
I haven't read that, no.
That was one of the suggestions that I had before.
That's the same guy who did
Ghost World.
Ghost World, yeah.
Yeah. Here's one that you read, The Complete Peanuts by Charles M. Schultz.
I've finally gotten back into reading Volume 2. I hadn't touched it in a long time. But
number 12 is Lone Wolf and Cub by Kazuo Koike.
Okay.
And Goseki Kojima. I have those. Number 13, The Complete Terry and the Pirates Volume 1 by Milton Caniff. And the final one, A Gregory Treasury by Mark Hempel.
I'm surprised that he mentions Terry and the Pirates rather than Steve Canyon, but
I thought Steve Canyon was Terry and the Pirates is more of an adventure thing, right?
Well, Steve Canyon was too. Actually, I've been.
I thought that was like a soap opera.
But it was sort of soap opery, but it had action. I've been reading. They've started publishing them on this site called Humorous Maximus. I think we talked about this before, but I've been reading it on there, and I mean it's at least in the early days, it's really an adventure story.
Yeah, I mean, it says in this article, dressed in leather, femme fatale, dragon lady came to embody Caniff's women to many. So I guess Terry and the Pirates came first, right?
Right.
So maybe what's important is that you see him kind of develop his style there. Although his depiction of April Kane, Terry's girlfriend, showed he was equally at home with moms and apple pie. In fact, Caniff drew the sexiest women in comics. Unfortunately, Caniff made very little money on Terry and the Pirates and quit in 1946 to produce Steve Canyon, a strip which he had a percentage of the action. George Wonder took over, and such was Caniff's place in the public consciousness that when Wonder died in 1987 and it was reported that the artist of Terry had died, Caniff's family received as many condolences as Wonder's. Interesting.
Yeah, I kind of remember we read the Milton Caniff part of Shop Talk
quite
a while back. But yeah,
I never really read any of his books.
He started Steve Canyon in like 1947, I think, 1947. And yeah, I mean he's already, you know, he's at the top of his game by then. He's really developed his storytelling in Terry and the Pirates, so he knows what he's doing right off the bat. And it's really, really well done, Steve Canyon.
I think
interesting plot twists and kind of avoids things that are, that, I mean, doesn't always do what you expect him to do, which is good. You know, you want to be surprised.
Also in this article, it does touch on what you're saying. You know, by the time he got to Steve Canyon, he was at the top of his game. It says, the initial crudeness of the early strip soon gives way to a more sophisticated style due to Caniff's collaboration with the talented Noel Sickles, another brilliant artist. So maybe the reason why, well, I don't know, do they have Steve Canyon published? But I was thinking maybe the reason why is because you get to see the development, not just of the artist, but of the strip as it goes along.
Maybe.
Do they have Steve Canyon in, is it published?
As books, yeah, I've seen it in previews. They're publishing, like, I don't know, like a year per book or something.
And then, well, of course, it does say that these are books that you probably haven't read but should. So there's got to be some sense of obscurity to the titles chosen.
Ah, that's true. And Steve Canyon went on for a long time, like about 40 years, I think.
Yeah.
And what always impresses me too, looking at those strips, is how much detail it is for a daily strip.
Right.
He worked his butt off on those strips. I mean, I don't think he had time to do anything else in his day. Get up in the morning, start drawing, finish one day's strip, and go to bed.
Well, I mean, that was his profession.
Yeah.
It's not like he was a graphic designer / web guy at a local college.
No, but I mean, you know, most daily strips are drawn much more simply than Steve Canyon.
Yes. The man was a master. Mm-hmm. And I think everybody recognizes that.
Yeah. Okay. So, thumbs up on Steve Canyon and thumbs up on Super Spy.
Yeah, Super Spy was an awesome story. If I was to give a 1 through a 10, this would be one of the few books that I'd say is a 10.
Yeah, I agree.
Maybe we should come up with a list as we go through these books, kind of ranking our picks.
Should we have?
I don't want to do a thumbs up and a thumbs down thing, but
should we do a bottom 10 as well as a top 10? I mean, we know what we know what the three bottom ones are.
But the thing is, you want to forget that experience. So if I keep getting reminded about Black Diamond and Tarzan versus Batman or Ghost and Batgirl, I'm going to continue focusing on how much time was wasted of my life that I can't have back. It just made me stupider reading it.
Just like Car Talk, another perfectly good hour wasted.
Yeah.
Except Car Talk is a lot better than any of those books. But
yeah, those books made me more stupider.
And we hope you enjoyed this week's discussion. Don't forget to check the podcast page at globalcomics.net for links referencing things we talked about in this episode. Also, be sure to visit our sponsor, comicsnow.com. Get up to 30% off everything in stock, or join their subscription service and get 35% off with no minimum order. Many of the comics we review on this podcast are supplied by comicsnow.com. Comics Now also provides Eric's newsletter, featured on our site, globalcomics.net. Let us know you're out there enjoying deconstructing comics. Visit us at globalcomics.net and send us an email, or click the link to frapper.com and put a pin in our Frapper map. And we'd greatly appreciate it if you'd give us a review in iTunes, Podcast Alley, or Podcast Pickle. Recently, we put out a call for our listeners to send us their comics to critique, and our call has been answered. Next week, we'll review a listener's comic. If you'd like us to comment on your comic as well, send it to podcast@globalcomics.net. If you want to send it via postal mail, email us and we'll send you the address. Thanks for listening. This is Tim. See you next week on Deconstructing Comics.
So long, Superman. I'm taking a vacation. I'll miss your medication. It helped to ease the pain.